The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
We all know, looking from here, the Middle East is an absolute mess, and it's a tragedy in Syria and elsewhere. For Israelis, that's very acute. There's a feel, Syria is right across the fence, and Jordan is stable, but who knows what might happen, and just beyond Jordan sits ISIS. To the south, there's Egypt right now, relatively stable because of Sisi, but there are jihadists in the Sinai, and there were even more. And of course, to the north is Lebanon, where there's Hezbollah and other groups. So Israelis are acutely aware of this mess going around them, and they feel targeted by it. They fear what happens if jihadists take over Gaza, even more extreme than Hamas, but certainly also the West Bank, should there be a deal. All this is not conducive for someone talking about hope and reason and change and future. And it's much more conducive to someone saying, I'm going to be tough. I'm not going to be naive about anyone. I won't let anyone pressure me into taking risks we don't want. That helps Netanyahu, but it also helps people to the right of Netanyahu.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 6th, 2014. It's a day before Pearl Harbor Day, but in Israel, Pearl Harbor Day was this week. The government fell, new elections, and here to talk about it all is my Brookings colleague, Natan Sachs. The Byzantine politics of Israeli coalitions is bewildering to many Americans, but we're going to unpack it all, what it means for the various Israeli-American mutual security interests and security differences, what it means for peace talks, and what it means for the future of the prime ministership of Benjamin Netanyahu. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Israeli Politics, Oy Vey. Natan, let's start out with just what happened this week.
Well, thanks for having me, Ben. What happened was a surprise for the Israelis. The government fell seemingly for no reason at all. What happened in practice, the details are, Netanyahu decided that he simply could not bridge the differences with especially two ministers, Finance Minister Yair Lapid and Justice Minister Tzipi Livni. The differences were about a few bills, in particular the nationality bill, one defining Israel, the nation state of the Jewish people, but more acutely, really, issues of the budget and issues of a zero VAT, value-added tax, that the finance minister wanted to promote. Deeper was just a breakdown of trust. Netanyahu and his ministers, not just these two, but others also, simply do not trust each other anymore. And the coalition that was built 2 years ago, which was always a strange coalition, Netanyahu decided simply couldn't survive.
So when you say Netanyahu and his ministers don't trust each other anymore, is the problem here Netanyahu or his ministers or both?
Well, I want to say both. But to answer your question more honestly, the problem is a combination with Netanyahu himself. He is very bad at managing personal relationships on the political level. He's not good at that art. And the second is the system. The system makes it very difficult. So Netanyahu, in his press conference where he announced the firing of these two ministers, Livni and Lapid, he talked about the fact that since the beginning of this government, it was an oppositionary government, a band of rivals, but in the worst way. And he's partly right. That's the way the Israeli system works. His finance minister saw himself as a political rival of the prime minister and as an heir to the prime minister. The same is true, by the way, of the foreign minister. of the most important minister from the right wing, the Minister of the Economy, Naftali Bennett, and in the past, though not right now, also the Justice Minister, Tzipi Livni. Right now, the Minister of Defense, who's from Netanyahu's own party, didn't see himself as a rival to Netanyahu himself, but that's an anomaly. Usually, the chief minister from the very party also considers himself a political rival. So that's on the system level. But Netanyahu is very bad at this. There's just no way around it. He was worse in the beginning. In 1999, his first government fell. He was elected in 1996, and he served for 3 years. Then he was again elected in 2009 and served till now. So he's the second longest-serving prime minister, cumulatively, in Israeli history, after David Ben-Gurion, the founding prime minister. In 1999, when his first government fell, he also fired a senior cabinet minister live on TV, just like now. Then it was Defense Minister Yitzhak Mordechai, who was of his own party, the Likud. Mordechai left and joined the center party. Mordechai was already doing this. That's why Netanyahu fired him. But this was really the apex of a terrible relationship between the young, brash Netanyahu and the whole senior leadership of the country, people in the military, but especially in the political system. Netanyahu is much better at that now. He manages to have relationships that are much more businesslike. He's calmed down a lot. He's become more secure, so much so that now he's really the master politician in a sense. But fundamentally, he's not a people's person. He has surprisingly few confidants. If you look at other prime ministers, they have aides that have been going with them for decades and are loyal to a fault. Right now, we have some aides of former Prime Minister Olmert going to jail for exactly that. Netanyahu has no one like that. If you ask people who are Netanyahu's confidants, the one name you get is Ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer. Guess what? He's in D.C. He's pretty close by here. He's not in Israel. There are a few, of course, but they change. And this is true also of politicians. Compare that to other ministers, also from the right, say Ariel Sharon. Ariel Sharon was a master of personal relationships. Even people he didn't get along with originally or people whose politics were dramatically different than his, they all spoke of him personally in very favorable terms. And when he was prime minister, he managed to give a lot of respect, a lot of deference to their roles and their posts, even if they weren't necessarily the best fit for their posts. Netanyahu is a much more secretive, suspicious man, very consumed with dangers, political and otherwise. And this doesn't really do well for a politician in leadership.
So when a government falls like this and the prime minister 2 years before he needs to call elections, calls elections, it is either because the prime minister is very strong or very weak, i.e. either it's because he lost support and he can't keep a coalition together anymore, or because he thinks he can do much better in this election than he did 2 years ago and that this is a good time for him. Which is this? Is this Netanyahu flexing his muscle, or is this Netanyahu throwing up his hands in the air because he can't keep it together?
I think that's an excellent question. It's an exact combination of both, actually. So on the one hand, he's weak, and he said even in his press conference, he said, well, the term in Hebrew, but he said, if you want to give me a mandate, you have to give me mandates, plural. And mandates in Hebrew is a word for seats in the parliament. And what he was saying was, the last elections, you, the voter, simply did not give my party enough seats. And so I had to go to this coalition, which I did not want. He said it very publicly, but it was common knowledge. He never wanted this coalition, a coalition that had the right wing, the far right wing, and the centrist secularist party of Lapid, but excluding the ultra-Orthodox. That's not a coalition he ever wanted. He wanted the ultra-Orthodox in. That would also weaken the veto power of Lapid, which is exactly what happened in the end. Lapid had this veto power. So that's on the one hand. He's just too weak. And he felt that this coalition from the beginning, he didn't have a real mandate for it. And I take his word at that. I think that's very true. And that's also a correct observation about the system. But the second is his main rival in this sort of petty argument, Lapid, is doing very badly in the polls. So in relative terms, Netanyahu thinks he's going to do better in the next elections. It's not that Netanyahu himself is going to do dramatically better. In other words, his party, Likud, is not going to grow dramatically. It will grow some, probably. But Lapid looks to lose, at least as if we take the polls at face value at the moment. The people who will gain more are probably actually to the right of Netanyahu. Bennett, the far-right Jewish Home Party, looks to be doing very well. And Lieberman will probably hold steady. Lieberman is now, the foreign minister, is now running separately from Netanyahu.
So he represents a Russian-based party.
Well, he's an interesting combination, and he's a very intriguing man, and he likes to also portray himself as an intriguing man. He himself is Russian-speaking originally, and he certainly has a lot of support among Russian speakers. But that characterization is weakened. He's portrayed himself and has managed to be perceived now as a general Israeli leader. He has many supporters who are not Russian speakers. His most senior ministers are not Russian speakers. He certainly draws on that base, but he's managed, to his credit, to create a political base that transcends that. And many people would be appalled at the idea of him prime minister, but not because he's of a specific sector or the Russian-speaking element. I'm sure there's prejudice about that always, but that's not the main issue. It's more about his positions. And he's managed to portray himself as a centrist leader as he wants to, always one who's going to surprise you. You never know where he's coming from. Is he very right-wing, or actually is he very pragmatic? Is he going to go with Netanyahu, or maybe will he go with the center like he did with Ehud Olmert? This is what the way he likes to portray himself. I'm full of surprises. I'm pragmatic. And so, yes, Russian speaker, certainly, but not just that.
So why has the Israeli population, in response to the perceived weakness and failures of Netanyahu, drifted right of Netanyahu rather than left of Netanyahu? Why is the big loser here anticipated to be Lapid rather than the Likud bloc that forms the core of the coalition?
A combination of a few things. First, it's not about Netanyahu in particular. So the movement to the right is mostly on security issues. It's not exactly right-wing in the sense of ideology. So, for example, it's not that many more Israelis now think of the West Bank in religious terms. All Israelis consider it to be, you know, homeland of the Jewish people, etc., but not necessarily politically something Israel should, the state of Israel should control. That's not changed fundamentally. What has gradually but very persistently since 2000, really, continued is a perception in the Israeli public that there is no Palestinian partner, that this is not the fault of Netanyahu or any other leader, hence Barak failing at reaching peace, Olmert failing at reaching peace, etc., etc. And so Israelis, by and large, don't think Netanyahu is the problem in that regard. They think the Palestinians are the problem. And so they've moved right in that sense. The second, and this may surprise people, the last podcast we did to get together with Khaled El-Ghindi and Tamara Wittes was during the Gaza conflict. The Israeli response then was not, why is the Israeli government using such a heavy hand on the population? The very widespread Israeli response was, why are you not finishing the job? This relatively small group, Hamas, is terrible for Israel, terrible also for Gazans. And so the common Israeli response feeling was, why don't you go in and topple them? Now, I think there's a majority of Israelis probably appreciate why Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yalon decided against that. Of course, the day after would be very difficult. And also just doing that wouldn't be simple. Of course, Israel could do it militarily, but it would be very difficult. It would also include terrible ethical dilemmas. But most importantly, the day after, who would then govern Gaza? Israelis don't want to do that. Nonetheless, the impetus to feel like you held the military back, that's a strong line. And that's something that very directly benefits Bennett. Bennett actually rose to prominence in Israeli politics 2 years ago after the previous conflict in Gaza. And there, too, he, who has military credentials, they're not very high level, but he himself was an officer in the most elite unit and sort of likes to talk about that and uses military kind of slang a lot. He gained from that perception. So it's a combination of both those things. One is just a general trend to the right. This includes also a demographic trend. The right-wing bases are growing demographically. The left-wing ones are not, by and large. Second, this perception of the Palestinians. And third, even just the immediate environment right now. I'd add one more thing to that, actually, which is the general sense of the Middle East. Of course, we all know, looking from here, the Middle East is an absolute mess, and it's a tragedy in Syria and elsewhere. For Israelis, that's very acute. Syria is right across the fence. And Jordan is stable, but who knows what might happen. And just beyond Jordan sits ISIS. To the south, there's Egypt right now, relatively stable because of Sisi, but there are jihadists in the Sinai, and there were even more. And of course, to the north is Lebanon, where there's Hezbollah and other groups. So Israelis are acutely aware of this mess going around them, and they feel targeted by it. They fear what happens if jihadists take over Gaza, even more extreme than Hamas, but certainly also the West Bank, should there be a deal. All this is not conducive for someone talking about hope and reason and change and future. And it's much more conducive to someone saying, I'm going to be tough. I'm not going to be naive about anyone. I won't let anyone pressure me into taking risks we don't want. That helps Netanyahu, but it also helps people to the right of Netanyahu.
And why is it that Lapid, who 2 years ago is this golden boy who comes out of nowhere and does much better than anybody expected him to do, and almost creates an environment in which Netanyahu is not presumptively going to form the government, has dissipated so completely in popular esteem?
One reason is that he was always a bit of a bluff, in the sense that he was this golden boy coming out of nowhere. He was a journalist beforehand, a very, very able writer. He was also a bit of an actor. He wrote some pop songs. I don't mean this to belittle him, but he was not prepared for this job, and especially not for finance minister. So he got so many seats last time in part by default. There was no one else in the center, and he drew many people who were not necessarily enamored with him, but were looking for a reasonable, centrist, not leftist, but centrist approach, that alternative to Netanyahu, and he gained from that. And this is a very common rubric in Israeli politics. All the way back to 1977, there was a party called the Democratic Party for Change, Dash. That was the big, famous third party led by former General Yigal Eliadin. And this captured really a very similar electorate, middle class, reasonable, not socialist, but not especially right-wing either, a group that has its roots all the way back with Chaim Weizmann, even before the state was born, what was called then the General Zionists. In 77, Dash did this, and they disappeared almost immediately later. Part of them joined the Begin government of 77, part of them did not. And the other part, in fact, was called Shinui. That was the party of Lapid's own father, Tommy Lapid. That was, again, a third party, a centrist party. Of course, it's not third. We have many parties in Israel. But this was the third large party. And they, too, after two elections, disappeared. Kadima, the party of Olmert Sharon and Olmert and then Livni, has now two seats and will disappear in the next election after being the governing party of Israel. So this is just a common trend. In that sense, don't blame Lapid. Blame the fickle electorate of the center. But the other is, and there's an important point, which is that Lapid was especially ill-suited for this job. Finance minister is not an easy job, and you have to be there's a lot of very complicated and unpopular decisions to make. The person who did this to him was Netanyahu. Netanyahu himself was cornered into being finance minister by Ariel Sharon once. And what Sharon did was made Netanyahu take very unpopular decisions as finance minister. But Netanyahu was actually qualified for the job. He knew economics. He had a very clear worldview, unpopular but clear. Lapid had none of that, and he had to take unpopular decisions. And in the process, he made everyone, including all the economists in the Ministry of Finance, look down at him as a finance minister.
So that big centrist block that shows up just in time to create new parties and then evaporates and destroys those new parties just as soon as everybody's gotten used to the idea of them as a long-term fixture of the political system. Should we assume that some other group is going to come up now in between now and March when these elections are going to happen and occupy that space? Or should we assume that that group will dissipate either into the Likud or into the Labor Party to the left?
We actually know the name of the next one. The next one is named Moshe Kahlon. That's going to be the new center party of Israel in a few months, on March 17th, probably, St. Patrick's Day. He is a former minister from the Likud, actually, so it's a new kind of centrist party. He left the Likud because partly of acrimonious relationships with Netanyahu, like many people, even inside his own Likud, most people inside his own Likud party. He was a minister of communication, of all things, but as minister of communication, he performed quite a dramatic reform of the cell phone industry. And the cell phone industry touches on everyone's pockets. Israelis love their cell phones like everyone else, and then a bit more. So, and this changed dramatically the pricing of the cell phone industry. And more generally, he's been mounting a actually intelligent campaign saying, I'm going to trust bust in other kinds of realms as well. The next target is going to be the banking system, which really is a very important system that actually is in dire need of reform and decentralization. So he's taking, again, like Lapid, going for economic issues, issues that talk to the middle class. But he's adding to that, well, one, a coherent worldview of what needs to be done, actually quite a right-wing, economically speaking, worldview, but a coherent worldview. He adds credentials. He's done it as a minister, and that's very important. Plus, we should add one more thing. He comes from the Likud, and he himself is a Mizrahi Jew, which gives him credibility, and a right-winger in terms of Palestinian issues, or formally. And that gives him credibility with more traditional voters of the Likud, and also of Shas, an ultra-Orthodox party that is a Sephardic party, and not all of them are ultra-Orthodox at all. And so this gives him credibility and also makes him very interesting. He's not just going to occupy the same electorate that Lapid did. He'll probably steal a bit from Lapid, but he will also steal from the right, from Likud and from Shas. And that makes him really potentially a deal breaker. He's the most interesting person perhaps to watch. What kind of numbers he gets will matter a lot, and what he does with them will matter tremendously. We don't even know his list. We have a lot of speculation about who might be in his list. Some of them are impressive people. But what he does with that mandate, and of course what kind of mandate he gets, that will determine a lot. And in part, I will just qualify, Lapid's not going to disappear. Even the polls that you see now, people disappointed with Lapid and the economic situation is not good and he's the Minister of Finance, he's still going to have a sizable party. He's going to be an important player. Added to him is Tzipi Livni, who ran separately, will probably run with him or maybe with Labor. The threshold has changed. The electoral law on the threshold has changed, making it difficult for smaller parties. So she will probably join with one of the two bigger parties on the center or left to ensure that she gets in. So we're still going to see the same electorate there, but added Moshe Kahlon, and that's going to be a very interesting change in Israeli politics because of where he comes from.
How confident are you that after, you know, March 17th, it'll be meet the new boss, same as the old boss, you know, goodbye, Netanyahu government. Hello, Netanyahu government.
This is all I've been trying to figure out in the last few days and all anyone is talking about. So first, the received wisdom. Netanyahu is going to be the next prime minister, period. That's where the bet is. And if I had to put money on anyone, it would clearly be Netanyahu. The numbers are quite simple. His bloc will be considerably bigger. He won a close margin last time. The polls, and they've been quite consistent, suggest that it's going to be larger this time. His biggest rival, or the star that we're expecting at the moment, is Naftali Bennett. He's to the right of Netanyahu. That means it'd be very difficult for Bennett to circumvent the Likud and build a coalition, because for the center to join Prime Minister Bennett would be almost unheard of. The relations of the United States and everyone else would just be terrible if the extreme right came to power. That said, I don't think it's impossible that he loses. How would he lose if it happened? Combination of two things. First, it's just the beginning of the campaign, and many things can happen in campaigns, especially in a multi-party system where, you know, demography is not destiny. You have all sorts of different parties that can parse the electorate in different ways. So Kahlon can do quite better than we thought. Lapid may do better than we thought. He's a very good campaigner, much better than finance minister. He himself is a journalist. He's a man of communication. He's very good looking, very good voice, very good speaker. Even just his press conference today was quite good. People are also very tired of Netanyahu. He's been prime minister for a long time. He's trusted, but he's not loved. There's really a very small number of Israelis who see him as just the best thing ever. He doesn't have an adoring crowd like some prime ministers have had. He's seen as better than the rest. So that's one thing. The second thing that could happen is you may see the elite, who are also fed up with Netanyahu, you may see some drama there. And if it were to happen, this is speculative, but for example, Lieberman, who always likes to portray himself as this wild card who could go with the center, may decide that he himself has just had it with Netanyahu, and more importantly, that he sees political gain in getting rid of Netanyahu, because if Netanyahu is not there, maybe he's now the responsible adult around. And so maybe he tries to form some kind of alliance, most likely post-elections, but maybe some kind of alliance with Kahlon, which would be a natural alliance, maybe even with Lapid, which is not unheard of. The electorate that supports Lieberman, certainly the Russian-speaking electorate, but also the non-Russian speakers, tend to be secular and tend to be middle-class or supportive of middle-class issues. And so in many respects, there's a commonality between Lieberman and Lapid, just as there was between Lieberman and Lapid's father, Shinui, under the Sharon government. And so there's some natural situation there. Who else would come into the coalition is a difficult one. The left would have a hard time with Lieberman. The ultra-Orthodox would have a hard time with Lapid. So it's difficult to chart it out right now, but it's not technically impossible. The cards are very much, the key person is Lieberman, and to a certain degree Kahlon, how much he gets in the end and how the numbers work out.
So from an American point of view, for For people like you, this stuff is an infinitely complicated and fascinating sport to watch in its own right, that they have more parties than the NFL has teams. They have these wonderful, horrible personalities. But to Americans who kind of watch Israeli politics from afar, I think there's really three issues that we think about that are everything else is just a way of analyzing, right? One is prospects for negotiations with Palestinians. One is regional security, particularly Iran. And one is the U.S.-Israel relationship itself. All three of these areas are obviously interrelated, and they all – Netanyahu has played a sort of fascinating role in all three of them. One of the people he has alienated on a consistent basis and doesn't get along with and is every single person in the United States government, particularly the president. How do you see this campaign and this election as implicating those three sort of core areas that our listenership would be thinking about, or that Americans more generally interested in sort of the role that Israel plays in American security concerns in the region?
Well, I'd say there are three scenarios. The first one is we might see a very similar government post-election. Let's say the polls hold as they are right now. That's obviously the best guess we have at the moment. One scenario is that Netanyahu forms a very similar government. It would include the ultra-Orthodox almost certainly. But maybe he gets Livni or Lapid to join again. And I say this partly because just last night on Channel 2 News in Israel, the main channel, they were asked, will you commit now that you will not join a Netanyahu government given all the acrimony? They would not commit. And the reason is they think, too, he's the likely winner. They're not going to admit it at the moment, but he's the likely winner. And in Israeli coalitionary politics, if you tell Tzipi Livni you can be an important minister that has an effect on U.S.-Israeli relations, she might go for it, as she did just now. In that case, we'll see more of the same, which is to say not very good in terms of U.S.-Israeli relations. Netanyahu, again, personally, most things are not personal, I think, in politics. They're more structural. But there are some personal things here, too. Netanyahu has been remarkably able not just to not get along with the president, but also with previous president, Bill Clinton. And so when he came into prime ministership this time, the Obama administration, the old hands in terms of Middle East, many of them were veterans of the Clinton administration. They, to begin with, couldn't stand Bibi, especially Bibi of the 90s. And Bibi would get along much better, of course, with a Republican administration, something he's much more close to ideologically. So if that's the case, we're going to see a continuation of the same. On the Palestinian front, not much prospect of anything good. In fact, danger of terrible things as well. That's, by the way, irrespective of the Israeli government. The situation is very bad, irrespective of that. On the Iran issue, we see right now an extension of the talks, which the Israelis are actually okay with, given the alternatives. But a deep disagreement between the Israelis and the Americans on what might constitute an okay deal in the end, if there was one. And if there isn't one, a deep disagreement between the Israelis and Congress on the one hand and the administration on the other hand over whether new sanctions would destroy the diplomatic route or maybe strengthen it. So in that, we're going to see a continuation. Let me give two other scenarios and I'll touch on the other topic. Another scenario is one of the more speculative ones that I mentioned. If we see some kind of dramatic shakeup on the elite level and a new government forming, it very much would depend who would be the prime minister. If somehow it's Avigdor Lieberman, which seems far-fetched but is technically possible, he would be an interesting case. He's been trying to portray himself as much more careful about U.S.-Israeli relations in this administration of Netanyahu. Previously, he was shunned in Washington, especially under Hillary Clinton. He gets along much better with Secretary Kerry, so it's reported. And part of that has to do with another topic, which you didn't touch on, which is social issues or value issues. There are deep differences in the way this administration in the United States and the Israeli administration see things on democracy, on the nationality bill that I mentioned, on relations between the majority and minority, Arab minority in Israel. The champion of bad relations between the Jewish majority and the Arab minority in Israel is Avigdor Lieberman. He's made an enormous amount of political gain targeting the minority, sometimes with good arguments. Their leadership of the Arab minority has done everything to help him in this. They've sort of a perverse symbiosis between him and some of the leadership. But this has been completely at the expense of about 20% of the Israeli citizenry, who are Arabic speaking. And the finance minister himself has been reckless with relations toward them. This is going to be a problem in Washington, no doubt. On other issues, he may turn out to be a bit more pragmatic than we think. He hints that he's going to be super pragmatic on the Palestinian issue. I remain skeptical on that, very skeptical. But on other issues, he has this approach of, I'm a bit like Ariel Sharon. I'm going to be a troublemaker until I'm at the top. But then you'll see I'm a reasonable man. That's what he tries to portray. Finally, there is always the chance that someone from the center or center-left could win in some capacity. If Lapid or Kahlon does remarkably well, maybe they could form a government. Kahlon more likely than Lapid, and even that is far-fetched. But in theory, that could happen. And we could see a change. U.S.-Israeli relations are partly a personal issue, and with a new direction, they could be considerably better.
Labor is simply a non-factor here.
Yeah, I haven't mentioned them yet. They're not a non-factor. The leader of the opposition, really until 2 days ago, actually, is Yitzhak Buzhi Herzog. He's the head of Labor. Labor is the traditional opposition party. is one of the two big parties in Israel. He's certainly an able man, and he's well respected in the political system. And unlike Netanyahu, gets along very well with colleagues and adversaries alike. And in the Labor Party, to get along with colleagues is no simple task. They like to put down their leaders all the time. Nonetheless, he's not charismatic. That's maybe his most difficult problem. Just in a popular level, he's not charismatic. And so in theory, he could be prime minister. It's not impossible, especially if the political elite decides to shake things up dramatically. But that is harder to see, in particular because you would probably need someone from the right. You would need Lieberman, you would need Kahlon. And for them to accept Herzog as prime minister, where their policies are so different and where he himself is not in particularly popular in the public, that's hard to imagine. So no, they're not irrelevant. They're certainly not irrelevant in parliament. They have some very good parliamentarians, but they're not about to take the government, no.
You mentioned the nationality bill, which has been characterized in the American press as privileging Israel's Jewish character over its democratic character. How significant is the bill in practice? Is this largely a symbolic issue, or does it have real consequences? And why does it have the salience in the Israeli political system that it seems to?
I think it is a very significant bill. First, I'd say there is no bill in terms singular. There are a few suggestions by the extreme right, both in the Likud and in the Jewish Home. And then there is to be a bridging proposal by Netanyahu that is supposed to be a watered-down version. The right-wingers have said that they would accept his version. But his version, that was one of the stumbling blocks between him, Livni, and Lapid.
And what does it do? I mean, what would it do if it existed?
Well, the versions we've seen so far, it would simply define Israel as a Jewish state, which is not saying much, since Israel was declared as a Jewish state, and it even relies on a UN resolution calling for the establishment of a Jewish and an Arab state, Arab meaning Palestinian Arab. And so in theory, not that much. But what it doesn't do is a very important and delicate tradition in Israel, which is not to say Jewish without democratic or democratic without Jewish. The conception, the way Israelis, jurists and others conceive of the Israeli constitutional system is as both complementary, Jewish and democratic, and in particularly democratic first, meaning that the Jewish element is very important in terms of a law of return. Jews can move to Israel, become citizens almost automatically, Jews and their children, in fact. And there are some other aspects which privilege Jewish issues in a sense. But there's also very strong safeguards on that not impinging on the rights of minorities of non-Jews in Israel. And the Supreme Court in particular, and especially the High Court of Justice, which is another hat that the Supreme Court wears sometimes, has been a very staunch defender of people's rights against these kinds of inequalities that might emerge. So you asked, why is this even coming up? Well, the real reason it's coming up is that there's a sense on the right in particular that the Supreme Court has been too activist. This may sound familiar from legal battles here in the United States, but it's exactly the same kind of argument about legislating from the bench. And the feeling is that especially President of the Supreme Court Aaron Barak, no longer president, three presidents ago, was very activist, in perception at least, and used a basic law of dignity, human dignity, to be very, interpreted it very broadly, and used it as a sweeping liberal kind of legislation, infringing in their perception on the Jewish nature. So one thing that is mentioned, for example, is that there's a Supreme Court or High Court of Justice, I should say, ruling that a community must accept Arab applicants for living in a specific community. In other words, you can't discriminate against someone because of the nationality. This would seem like commonplace liberal equality to Americans and to me, honestly. But for some, this seems like an infringement of the idea of a Jewish state, partly because before the state existed, the idea of purchasing land and creating communities for Jews was very central. Of course, once the state exists, it needs to treat human beings as such. To counter this kind of, in their view, infringement on the status quo in favor of democracy and liberal values, they want to counter it with an establishment in law of the Jewishness of the state. Without mentioning equality, without emphasizing all the things that, for example, the Declaration of Independence of Israel, which does not have a legal standing but has a very strong symbolic and moral standing in Israel, that does mention equality of race, sex, by the way, religion, very clearly alongside Jewish state. Without doing that, there is a very real fear, and I think justified fear, that it could erode the democratic nature of Israel. This is not nearly as dramatic or immediate or acute as diehard critics of Israel would suggest, but nonetheless, it is very important. And for Israelis and for supporters of Israel or just observers, I think it is a very worrisome issue. So much so that the president of Israel, who's a right-winger from the Likud party, Ovi Rivlin, came out staunchly against this bill, as did his predecessor, Shimon Peres. Less surprisingly, he's from the Labor originally. Jurists have come out against it, including jurists who oppose legal activism, saying in particular that it is not necessarily the bill itself, the idea of defining Israel as a Jewish state is not in and of itself controversial, but that any attempt to meddle with a very delicate balance that exists and is still evolving is a mistake. That in fact ambiguity, the ambiguity that existed in the Declaration of Independence and since then in the common law tradition of Israel is what enabled very different narratives to exist together. The balance between Jewish and democratic need not be a complete contrast, to my mind at least. There are many nation states in the world. Israel is not nearly the only one. But it is a difficult balance, and it can become a conflict if you have laws such as this that try to privilege one over the other.
So this weekend, Brookings is doing its annual U.S.-Israel dialogue, which I understand you will be participating in. This is sort of a ripe time to do it. Tell us sort of about what's on the agenda.
This is a Saban Forum that we run from the Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings, and it's in its 11th year now. And it's really supposed to be a high-level and mostly off-the-record dialogue between Israeli and American leadership, members of the leadership. And this is an especially important time, first because U.S.-Israeli relations, as you mentioned earlier, are really in a low point in many different regards. And many of these issues are surprisingly misunderstood on both sides. You'd think two countries that know each other so well and care about each other so much would have a much better understanding. And, of course, many of the leaders do meet each other. But this really is a unique opportunity for just a swath of the Israeli leadership to come to Washington, both on the political level, several ministers of the highest rank, and really the highest rank of the journalists of Israel coming to D.C., and they're meeting the very highest rank of the U.S. administration as well. Last year, publicly, the president spoke, as did the Secretary of State. And so this year, we're talking in particular about different aspects of U.S.-Israeli relations, some of which you mentioned, Iran, issues of values, issues of ethics and fighting during war, which we talked about in the previous podcast I did here, and all these issues that on the one hand seem to be superfluous because the relationship is supposedly unbreakable, unshakable, etc., but on the other hand are dramatically misunderstood on the two sides or simply in deep disagreement on those sides. So that's what the forum partly does. Now we have the added twist that exactly the week the forum is convening elections are called in Israel. So it's going to be an interesting scene also because many of the politicians come to Washington so as to be seen on television in Israel. The Saban Forum is very salient in the Israeli media. And so some ministers and politicians come here to be seen in the streets of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. And they will try to give speeches. Most of it is off the record, but they will try to give speeches and mingle with the press so that people back home will know that they are so important that they meet with the highest ranking ministers in the United States. And of course they do, and they're actually right. And so this is an opportunity for them in part to do that, but to do that in a visible way to the United States, to the leadership at least of the United States. And I think that's very valuable. One last thing that's very valuable is that Americans and Israelis sometimes, although they are very interested in each other, they see each other as they'd like to see each other or as they're portrayed in very loud media. When you have an opportunity to have something off the record, something that is slightly more representative, we have people coming from across the political spectrum, left to right, and we have in on the U.S. side as well, people from across the political spectrum. This gives an opportunity for slightly more frank and honest conversation. Because it's off the record, it can be quite frank. And disagreements can come out, and they're aired out. And they're not necessarily resolved, of course, but I think that in itself is very useful.
Thanks very much for coming in, Natan.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the folks in the Brookings studio for hosting Natan and me. Our music, as always, is performed by the estimable Sophia Yan, who always says of Israeli coalitions,
"The last elections, you, the voter, simply did not give my party enough seats."
You need to help us promote the Lawfare podcast. Tweet it, Facebook like it, review it on whatever podcast distribution systems you use. Take a photo of yourself on Instagram listening to the podcast. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.